Greetings from the Audible Local Ledger, located in beautiful Mashpee, Massachusetts, and serving the Cape, the Islands, and the South Coast. The Ledger delivers information and entertainment to the print-impaired from our Cape-based volunteer readers, as well as from other services around the state, such as the Talking Information Center in Marshfield and the Audio Journal in Worcester. You may sometimes hear their content, but it's the Cape's very own Audible Local Ledger that is broadcasting it. My name is Caroline Paulino, and I will be reading selections from Bradbury and Frost this week. As we draw closer to Halloween, I am continuing to read the slightly twisted tales of Ray Bradbury. The first is the short story, The Exiles. And who are these exiles? Our very favorite writers of horror. The Exiles by Ray Bradbury. Their eyes were fire, and the breath flamed out the witches' mouths as they bent to probe the cauldron with greasy stick and bony finger. When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain? They danced drunkenly on the shore of the empty sea, fouling the air with their three tongues and burning it with their cat's eyes, malevolently aglitter. Round about the cauldron go, in the poison entrails throw, double, double toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble. They paused and cast a glance about. Where's the crystal? Where's the needles? Here, good. Is the yellow wax thickened? Yes. Pour it in the iron mold. Is the wax figure done? They shaped it like molasses adrip on their green hands. Shove the needle through the heart. The crystal. Fetch it from the tarot bag. Dust it off. Have a look. They bent to the crystal, their faces white. See, see, see! A rocket ship moved through space from the planet Earth to the planet Mars. On the rocket ship, men were dying. The captain raised his head tiredly. We'll have to use the morphine, but Captain, you see yourself this man's condition. The captain lifted the wool blanket, and the man restrained beneath the wet sheet moved and groaned. The air was full of sulphurous thunder. I saw it. The man opened his eyes and stared at the port, where there were only black spaces, reeling stars, Earth far removed, and the planet Mars rising large and red. I saw it. A bat, a huge thing, a bat with a man's face, spread over the front port, fluttering. Pulse? Asked the captain. The orderly measured it. 130. He can't go on with that. Use the morphine. Come along, Smith. They moved away. Suddenly the floor plates were laced with bone and white skulls that screamed. The captain did not dare look down, and over the screaming he said, "Is this where Purse is?" Turning in at a hatch. A white-smocked surgeon stepped away from the body. "I just don't understand it. How did Purse die?" "We don't know, Captain. It wasn't his heart, his brain, or shock. He just died." The captain felt the doctor's wrist, which changed to a hissing snake and bit him. The captain did not flinch. "Take care of yourself. You've a pulse, too." The doctor nodded. Purse complained of pains. "Needles," he said in his wrists and legs. Said he felt like wax, melting. He fell. I helped him up. He cried like a child. Said he had a silver needle in his heart. He died. Here he is. We can repeat the autopsy for you. Everything is physically normal. That's impossible. He died of something. The captain walked to a port. He smelled of menthol and iodine and green soap on his polished and manicured hands. His white teeth were dentrified, and his ears scored to a pinkness, as were his cheeks. His uniform was the color of new salt, and his boots were black mirrors shining below him. His crisp, crew-cut hair smelled of sharp alcohol. Even his breath was sharp and new and clean. There was no spot to him. He was a fresh instrument, honed and ready, still hot from the surgeon's oven. The men with him were from the same mold. One expected huge brass keys spiraling slowly from their backs. They were expensive, talented, well-oiled toys, obedient and quick. The captain watched the planet Mars grow very large in space. "We'll be landing in an hour on that damned place, Smith. Did you see any bats or have any other nightmares?" "Yes, sir. The month before our rocket took off from New York, sir. White rats biting my neck, drinking my blood. I didn't tell. I was afraid you wouldn't let me come on this trip." "Never mind," sighed the captain. "I had dreams, too. In all of my 50 years, I never had a dream until that week before we took off from Earth. And then every night I dreamt I was a white wolf caught on a snowy hill, shot with a silver bullet, buried with a stake in my heart." He moved his head toward Mars. "Do you think, Smith, they know we're coming?" "Well, we don't know if there are Martian people, sir." "Don't we? They began frightening us off 8 weeks ago before we started. They've killed Peirce and Reynolds now. Yesterday, they made Greenville go blind. How? I don't know. Bats, needles, dreams, men dying for no reason. I'd call it witchcraft in another day. But this is the year 2120, Smith. We're rational men. This all can't be happening. But it is. Whoever they are, with their needles and their bats, they'll try to finish us all." He swung about. "Smith, fetch those books from my file. I want them when we land." 200 books were piled on the rocket desk. "Thank you, Smith. Have you glanced at them? Think I'm insane?" "Perhaps. I mean, it's a crazy hunch. At that last moment, I ordered these books from the Historical Museum because of my dreams. 20 nights I was stabbed, butchered, a screaming bat pinned to a surgical mat, a thing rotting underground in a black box, bad, wicked dreams. Our whole crew dreamed of witch things and were things, vampires and phantoms, things they couldn't know anything about. Why? Because books on such ghastly subjects were destroyed a century ago. By law. Forbidden for anyone to own the grisly volumes. These books you see here are the last copies, kept for historical purposes in the locked museum vaults." Smith bent to read the dusty titles. "Tales of Mystery and Imagination by Edgar Allan Poe. Dracula by Bram Stoker. Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. The Turn of the Screw, Henry James. The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, Washington Irving. Rappaccini's Daughter, Nathaniel Hawthorne. An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge by Ambrose Bierce. Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll. The Willows by Algernon Blackwood. The Wizard of Oz by Frank Baum. The Weird Shadow over Innsmouth by H.P. Lovecraft. And more books by Walter de la Mare, Wakefield, Harvey, Wells, Asquith, Huxley, all forbidden authors. All burned in the same year that Halloween was outlawed and Christmas was banned. But, sir, what good are those to us on the rocket? I don't know, sighed the captain. Yet. The three hags lifted the crystal where the captain's image flickered, his tiny voice tinkling out of the glass. I don't know, sighed the captain. Yet. The three witches glared redly into one another's faces. We haven't much time, said one. Better warn them in the city. They'll want to know about the books. It doesn't look good. The fool of a captain. In an hour they'll land their rocket. The three hags shuddered and blinked up at the Emerald City by the edge of the dry Martian sea. In its highest window, a small man held a blood-red drape aside. He watched the wastelands where the three witches fed their cauldron and shaped the waxes. Farther along, 10,000 other blue fires and laurel incenses, black tobacco smokes and fir weeds, cinnamon and bone dust rose soft as moths through the Martian night. The man counted the angry magical fires. Then, as the three witches started, he turned. The crimson drape, released, fell, causing the distant portal to wink like a yellow eye. Mr. Edgar Allan Poe stood in the tower window, a faint vapor of spirits upon his breath. Hecate's friends are busy tonight, he said, seeing the witches far below. A voice behind him said, I saw Will Shakespeare on the shore earlier, whipping them on. All along the sea, Shakespeare's army alone. Tonight numbers thousands. The three witches, Oberon, Hamlet's father, Puck, all of them thousands. Good Lord, a regular sea of people. Good William, Poe turned. He let the crimson drape fall shut. He stood for a moment to observe the raw stone room, the black timbered table, the candle flame, the other man, Mr. Ambrose Bierce, sitting very idly there, lighting matches and watching them burn down, whistling under his breath now and then, laughing to himself. "'We'll have to tell Mr. Dickens now,' said Poe. "'We've put it off too long. "'It's a matter of hours. "'Will you go down to the home with me, Bierce?' "'Bierce glanced up merrily. "'I've just been thinking. "'What'll happen to us? "'If we can't kill the rocket men off, frighten them away, "'then we'll have to leave, of course. "'We'll go on to Jupiter. "'And when they come to Jupiter, we'll go on to Saturn. "'And when they come to Saturn, we'll go on to Uranus.' Or Neptune, and then on out to Pluto. Where then? Mr. Poe's face was weary. There were fire coals remaining, fading in his eyes, and a sad wildness in the way he talked, and a uselessness of his hands and the way his hair fell lanky over his amazing white brow. He was like a Satan of some lost dark cause, a general arrived from a derelict invasion. His silky, soft black mustache was worn away by his musing lips. He was so small his brow seemed to float, vast and phosphorescent by itself, in the dark room. "We have the advantage of superior forms of travel," he said. "We can always hope for one of their atomic wars, disillusion. The Dark Ages come again, the return of superstition. We could go back then to Earth, all of us, in one night." Mr. Poe's black eyes brooded under his round and luminant brow. He glazed at the ceiling. So they're coming to ruin this world, too. They won't leave anything undefiled, will they? Does a wolf pack stop until it's killed its prey and eaten the guts? It should be quite a war. I shall sit on the sidelines and be the scorekeeper. So many earthmen boiled in oil. So many earthmen stabbed with needles. So many red deaths put to flight by a batter of hypodermic syringes. Ha! Poe swayed angrily, faintly drunk with wine. What did we do? Be with us, Bierce, in the name of God. Did we have a fair trial before a company of literary critics? No. Our books were plucked up by neat, sterile surgeon's pliers and flung into vats to boil, to be killed of all their mortuary germs. Damn them all. I find our situation amusing, said Bierce. They were interrupted by a hysterical shout from the tower stair. Mr. Poe! Mr. Bierce! Yes, yes, we're coming. Poe and Bierce descended to find a man gasping against the stone passage wall. Have you heard the news? He cried immediately, clawing at them like a man about to fall over a cliff. In an hour they'll land. They're bringing books with them, old books, the witches said. What are you doing in the tower at a time like this? Why aren't you acting? Poe said, We're doing everything we can, Blackwood. You're new to all this. Come along. We're going to Mr. Charles Dickens' place to contemplate our doom. Our black doom, said Bierce, with a wink. They moved down the echoing throats of the castle, level after dim green level, down into mustiness and decay and spiders and dreamlike webbing. Don't worry, said Poe, his brow like a huge white lamp before them, descending, sinking, all along the Dead Sea tonight. I'll call the others, your friends and mine. Blackwood, Bierce, they're all there. The animals, and the old woman, and the tall men with sharp white teeth. The traps are waiting. The pits, yes, and the pendulums. The Red Death. Here he laughed quietly. Yes, even the Red Death. I never thought the time would come when a thing like the Red Death could actually be. But they asked for it, and they shall have it. But are we strong enough, wondered Blackwood. Well, how strong is strong? They won't be prepared for us, at least. They haven't the imagination. Those clean young rocket men with their antiseptic bloomers and fishbowl helmets, with their new religion, about their necks on gold chains, scalpels. Upon their head, a diadem of microscopes, in their holy fingers streaming incense urns, which in reality are only germicidal ovens of steaming out superstition. The names of Poe, Bierce, Hawthorne, Blackwood, blasphemy to their clean ears, to their clean lips. Outside the castle, they advanced through a watery space, a tarn that was not a tarn, which misted before them like the stuff of nightmares, the air filled with wing sounds and a whirring, a motion of winds and blacknesses. Voices changed. Figures swayed at campfires. Mr. Poe watched the needles knitting, knitting, knitting in the firelight. Knitting pain and misery, knitting wickedness into wax marionettes, clay puppets. The cauldron smells of wild garlic and cayenne and saffron, hissed up to fill the night with evil pungency. Get on with it, said Poe. I'll be back. All down the empty seashore, black figures spindled and waned, grew up, and blew into black smoke in the city. Bells rang in mountain towers, and licorice ravens spilled out with the bronze sounds and spun away to ashes. over a lonely moor and into a small valley, Poe and Bierce hurried and found themselves quite suddenly on a cobbled street in cold, bleak, biting weather, with people stomping up and down stony courtyards to warm their feet. Foggy withal, and candles flaring in the windows of the offices and shops, where hung the Yuletide turkeys. At a distance, some boys, all bundled up, snorting their pale breaths in the wintry air, were trilling, "God rest ye merry gentlemen," while the immense tones of the great clock continuously sounded midnight. Children dashed by from the bakers with dinners all asteam in their grubby fists, on trays and under silver bowls. At a sign, which read, "Scrooge, Marley, and Dickens," Poe gave the Marley-faced knocker a rap, and from within, as the door popped open a few inches, a sudden gust of music almost swept them into a dance. And there, beyond the shoulder of the man who was sticking a trim goatee and mustaches at them, was Mr. Fezziwig clapping his hands, and Mrs. Fezziwig, one vast, substantial smile, dancing and colliding with other merrymakers, while the fiddle chirped and laughter ran about a table like chandelier crystals given a sudden push of wind. The large table was heaped with brawn and turkey and holly and geese, with minced pies, stuckling pigs, wreaths of sausages, oranges and apples. And there was Bob Cratchit and Little Dorrit and Tiny Tim and Mr. Fagin himself, and a man who looked as if he might be an undigested bit of beef, a bloat of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of an underdone potato. Who else but Mr. Marley, chains and alls, while the wine poured and the brown turkeys did their excellent best to steam? "What do you want?" demanded Mr. Charles Dickens. "We've come to plead with you again, Charles. We need your help," said Poe. "Help? Do you think I would help you fight against those good men coming in the rocket? I don't belong here. Anyway, I mean, my books were burned by mistake. I'm no supernaturalist, no writer of horrors and terrors like you. Poe, you Bierce or the others, I'll have nothing to do with your terrible people." "Well, you are a persuasive talker," reasoned Poe. "You could go to meet the rocket men, lull them, lull their suspicions, and then we could take care of them." Mr. Dickens eyed the folds of the black cape which hid Poe's hands from it. Smiling, Poe drew forth a black cat. "For one of our visitors, and for the others?" Poe smiled again, well pleased. "The premature burial?" "You are a grim man, Mr. Poe." "I am a frightened and an angry man. I am a god, Mr. Dickens, even as you are a god, even as we all are gods. And our inventions, our people, if you wish, have not only been threatened, but banished and burned, torn up and censored, ruined and done away with. The worlds we created are falling into ruin. Even gods must have fights." "So," Mr. Dickens tilted his head, impatient to return to the party, the music, the food, "perhaps you can explain why we are here. How did we come here? War begets war. Destruction begets destruction. On Earth, a century ago, in the year 2020, they outlawed our books. Oh, what a horrible thing, to destroy our literary creations that way. It summoned us out of, what, death? The beyond? I don't like abstract things. I don't know. I only know that our worlds and our creations called us, and we tried to save them. And the only saving thing we could do was wait out the century here on Mars, hoping Earth might overweight itself with these scientists and their doubtings. But now they're coming to clean us out of here, and our dark things, and all the alchemists, witches, vampires, were things, one by one, retreated across space as a science made inroads through every country on Earth, and finally left us no alternative at all but Exodus. You must help us. You have a good speaking manner. We need you. I repeat, I am not of you. I don't approve of you and the others, cried Dickens angrily. I was no player with witches and vampires and midnight things. Oh, what of a Christmas carol? Ridiculous. One story. No, I wrote a few others about ghosts, perhaps, but what of that? My basic works were none of that nonsense. Mistaken or not, they grouped you with us. They destroyed your books. Your worlds, too. You must hate them, Mr. Dickens. I admit they are stupid and rude, but that is all. Good day. Let Mr. Marley come, at least. No. The door slammed. As Poe turned away down the street, skimming over the frosty ground, the coachman, playing a lively air on a bugle, came a great coach out of which Cherry Red, laughing and singing, piled the Pickwickians, banging on the door, shouting Merry Christmas good and loud, when the door was opened by the fat boy. Mr. Poe hurried along the midnight shore of the dry sea. By fires and smoke he hesitated to shout orders, to check the bubbling cauldrons, the poisons, and the chalked pentagrams. Good, he said, and ran on. Fine, he shouted and ran again. People joined him and ran with him. Here were Mr. Coppard and Mr. Machen running with him now, and there were hating serpents and angry demons and fiery bronze dragons and spitting vipers and trembling witches like the barbs and nettles and thorns and all the vile flotsam and jetsam of the retreating sea of imagination left on the melancholy shore, whining and frothing and spitting. Mr. Machen stopped. He sat like a child on the cold sand. He began to sob. They tried to soothe him, but he would not listen. I just thought, he said, what happens to us on the day when the last copies of our books are destroyed? The air whirled. Don't speak of it. We must, wailed Mr. Machen. Now as the rocket comes down, you, Mr. Poe, you, Coppard, you, Bierce, all of you grow faint, like wood smoke, blowing away. Your faces melt. Death. Real death for all of us. We exist only through Earth's sufferance. If a final edict tonight destroyed our last few works, we'd be like lights put out. Coppard brooded gently. I wonder who I am. In what Earth mind tonight do I exist? In some African hut, some hermit reading my tales? Is he the lonely candle of the wind of time and science? The flickering orb sustaining me here? In rebellious exile? Is it him? Or some boy in a discarded attic finding me only just in time? Oh, last night I felt ill to the marrows of me, for there is a body of the soul as well as a body of the body, and this soul body ached in all its glowing parts, and last night I felt myself a candle guttering, when suddenly I sprang up, given new light, as some child sneezing with dust in some yellow garret on earth once more found a worn, time-specked copy of me, and so I'm given a short respite. A door banged wide in a little hut by the shore. A thin, short man with flesh hanging from him in folds stepped out and, paying no attention to the other, sat down and stared into his clutched fists. "There's the one I'm sorry for," whispered Blackwood. "Look at him dying away. He was once more real than we who were men. They took him, a skeleton thought, and clothed him in centuries of pink flesh and snow beard and red velvet suit and black boot, made him reindeers, tinsel, holly, and after centuries of manufacturing him, they drowned him in a vat of Lysol, you might say. The men were silent. What must it be on earth, wondered Foe, without Christmas? No hot chestnuts, no tree, no ornaments or drums or candles, nothing but the snow and wind and the lonely factual people. They all looked at the thin old man with the scraggly beard and faded red velvet suit. Have you heard his story? Oh, I can imagine it. The glittered-eyed psychiatrist, the clever sociologist, the resentful froth-mouthed educationalist, the antiseptic parents. A regrettable situation, said Beer, smiling, for the Yuletide merchants who, toward the last there, as I recall, were beginning to put up holly and sing Noel the day before Halloween. With any luck at all this year, they might have started on Labor Day. Pierce did not continue. He felt forward with a sigh as he lay upon the ground. He had time to say only, "How interesting." And then as they all watched, horrified, his body burned into blue dust and charred bone, the ashes of which fled through the air in black tatters. Beers! Beers! Gone. His last book, gone. Someone on earth just now burned it. God rest him. Nothing of him left now. For what are we but books? And when those are gone, nothing's to be seen. A rushing sound filled the sky. They cried out, terrified, and looked up. In the sky, dazzling it with sizzling fire clouds, was the rocket. Around the men on the seashore, lanterns bobbed. There was a squealing and a bubbling and an odor of cooked smells. Candle-eyed pumpkins lifted the cold, clear air. Thin fingers clenched into fists, and a witch screamed from her withered mouth. Ship, ship, break, fall, ship, ship, burn all, crack, flake, shake, melt, mummy dust, cat pelts. Time to go, murmured Blackwood, on to Jupiter, on to Saturn or Pluto. Run away, shouted Poe in the wind, never. I am a tired old man. Poe gazed into the old man's face and believed him. He climbed atop a huge boulder and faced the 10,000 gray shadows and gray lights and yellow eyes on the hissing winds. The powders, he shouted. A thick, hot smell of bitter almond, civet, cumin, worm seed, and orris. The rocket ship came down, steadily down, with a shriek of a damned spirit. Poe raged at it. He flung his fists up, and the orchestra of heat and smell and hatred answered in symphony. Like stripped tree fragments, bats flew upward. Burning hearts flung like missiles burst in bloody fireworks down the singed air. Down, down, relentlessly down, like a pendulum the rocket came. And Poe howled furiously and shrank back with every sweep and sweep of the rocket cutting and the ravening the air. All the Dead Sea seemed a pit in which, trapped, they waited the sinking of the dreaded machinery, the glistening axe. They were people under the avalanche. The snakes! Screamed Poe, and luminous serpents of undulant green hurtled toward the rocket. But it came down, a sweep, a fire, a motion, and it lay panting out exhaustions of red plumage in the sand a mile away. At it, shrieked Poe. The plans changed. Only one chance. Run. At it. At it. Drown them with our bodies. Kill them. And as if he had commanded a violent sea to change its course, to suck itself from the primeval beds, the whirls and savage gouts of fire spread and ran like wind and rain and stark lightning over the sea sands, downing empty river deltas, shadowing and screaming, whistling and whining, sputtering and coalescing toward the rocket, which, extinguished, lay like a clean metal torch in the farthest hollow, as if a great charred cauldron of sparkling lava had been overturned. The boiling people and snapping animals churned down the dry fathoms. "Kill them!" screamed Poe, running. The rocket men leaped out of their ships, guns ready. They stalked about, sniffing the air like hounds. They saw nothing. They relaxed. The captain stepped forth last. He gave sharp commands. Wood was gathered, kindled, and a fire leaped up in an instant. The captain beckoned his men into a half-circle about him. "A new world," he said, forcing himself to speak deliberately, though he glanced nervously, now and again, over his shoulder at the empty sea. "The old world left behind. A new start. What more symbolic than we here dedicate ourselves all the more firmly to science and progress?" He nodded crisply to his lieutenants. "The books." Firelight limned the faded gilt titles. "The Willows. The Outsider. Behold. The Dreamer. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The Land of Oz. The Land That Came Forgot. A Midsummer's Night Dream. And the monstrous names of Machen and Edgar Allan Poe and Cabell and Dunsany and Blackwood and Lewis Carroll. The names. The old names. The evil names." The captain ripped the pages from the books, leaf by seared leaf. He fed them into the fire. A scream! Leaping back, the men stared beyond the firelight and the edges of the encroaching and uninhabited sea. Another scream! A high and wailing thing like the death of a dragon and the thrashing of a bronzed whale left gasping when the waters of a Leviathan sea drain down like shingles and evaporate. It was the sound of air rushing to fill a vacuum, where, a moment before, there had been something. The captain neatly disposed of the last book by putting it into the fire. The air stopped quivering. Silence. The rocket men leaned and listened. "Captain, did you hear it?" "No. Like a wave, sir, on the sea bottom? I saw something. Over there. A black wave? Big. Running at us." "You were mistaken. There, sir. What? See it? There. The city, way over. The green city near the lake. It's splitting in half. It's falling." The men squinted and shuffled forward. Smith stood trembling among them. He put his hand to his head as if to find a thought there. "Ah, I remember. Yes, now I do. A long time back, when I was a child. A book I read. A story. Oz, I think it was. Yes, Oz, the Emerald City of Oz. Oz? Never heard of it. Yes, Oz. That's what it was. I saw it just now, like in the story. I saw it fall." "Smith." "Yes, sir." "Report for psychoanalysis tomorrow." "Yes, sir." A brisk salute. "Be careful." Then men tiptoed, guns alert, beyond the ship's aseptic light to gaze at the long sea and the low hills. "Why," whispered Smith, disappointed, "there's no one here at all, is there? No one here at all." The wind blew sand over his shoes, whining. Second story today is also by Ray Bradbury, and it's for all of us who have wondered some nights What's that noise that I hear up in the attic or in the walls? It's entitled Trapdoor. Clara Peck had lived in the old house for some 10 years before she made this strange discovery. Halfway upstairs to the second floor, on the landing, in the ceiling. The trapdoor. Well, my God. She stopped dead, mid-stairs, to glare at the surprise, daring it to be true. It can't be. How could I have been so blind? I mean, good grief, there's an attic in my house. She had marched up and downstairs 1,000 times on 1,000 days and never seen. Damned old fool! And she almost tripped going down, having forgotten that she had come what she had come up for in the first place. Before lunch, she arrived to stand under the trapdoor again, like a tall, thin, nervous child with pale hair and cheeks, her two bright eyes darting, fixing, staring. Now I've discovered the damn thing, and what do I do with it? Storage room up there, I bet. Well, and she went away, vaguely troubled, feeling her mind slipping off out of the sun. To hell with that, Clara Peck, she said, vacuuming the parlor. You're only 57, not senile yet, by God. But still, why hadn't she noticed? It was the quality of the silence that was it. Her roof had never leaked, so no water had ever tapped at the ceilings. The high beams had never shifted in any wind, and there were no mice. If the rain had whispered, or the beams groaned, or the mice danced in her attic, she would have glanced up and found the trapdoor. But the house had stayed silent, and she had stayed blind. Bosh! She cried at supper. She finished the dishes, read until 10, went to bed early. It was during that night that she heard the first faint Morse code tapping, the first graffiti scratching above, behind the blank ceiling's pale lunar face. Half asleep, her lips whispered, "Mouse?" And then it was dawn. Going downstairs to fix breakfast, she fixed the trapdoor with her steady small girl's stare and felt her skinny fingers twitch to go fetch the stepladder. "Hell," she muttered, "why bother to look at an empty attic? Next week, maybe." For about 3 days after that, the trapdoor vanished. That's it. She forgot to look at it, so it might be as well not have been there. But around midnight, on the third night, she heard the mouse sounds, or the whatever they were sounds, drifting across her bedroom ceiling like milkweed ghosts touching the lost surfaces of the moon. From that odd thought, she shifted to tumbleweeds or dandelion seeds or just plain dust shaken from the attic sill. She thought of sleep, but the thought didn't take. Lying flat in her bed, she watched the ceiling so fixedly she felt she could X-ray whatever it was that cavorted behind the plaster. A flea circus? A tribe of gypsy mice in exodus from a neighbor's house? Several had been shrouded recently to look like dark circus tents so that pest killers could toss in killer bombs and run off to let the secret life in the places die. The secret life had most probably packed its fur luggage and fled. Clara Peck's boarding house attic, free meals, was their new home, away from home. And yet, as she stared, the sounds began again. They shaped themselves into patterns across the wide ceiling's brow, long fingernails that scraping wandered to this corner and that of the shutaway chamber above. Clara Peck held her breath. The patterns increased. The soft prowlings began to cluster toward an area above and beyond her bedroom window. It was as if the tiny creatures, whatever they were nuzzling another secret door above, wanting out. Slowly, Clara Peck sat up in bed and slowly put her weight to the floor, not wanting it to creak. Slowly, she cracked her bedroom door. She peered out into the hall flooded with cold light from a full moon, which poured through the landing window to show her the trap door. Now, as if summoned by her warmth, the sound of the tiny lost ghost feet above rushed to cluster and fret at the trapdoor rim itself. "Christ," thought Clara Peck, "they hear me. They want me to..." The trapdoor shuddered gently, with the tiny rocking weights of whatever it was, a rustle in there, and more of the invisible spider feet, a rodent feet, of the blown curls of old and yellow newspapers touched and rustled the wooden frame. Louder, and still louder. Clara was about to cry, "Go get..." When the phone rang, "Gah," gasped Clara Peck. She felt a ton of blood plunge like a broken weight down her frame to crush her toes. "Gah." She ran to seize, lift, and strangle the phone. "Who?" she cried. "Clara! It's Emma Crowley. What's wrong?" "Oh, my God," shouted Clara. "You scare the hell out of me, Emma. Why are you calling this late?" There was a long silence as the woman across town found her own breath. "It's silly. I couldn't sleep. I had this hunch. Emma?" "No, let me finish. All of a sudden I thought, Clara's not well, or Clara's hurt, or..." Clara Peck sank to the edge of the bed, the weight of Emma's voice pulling her down. Eyes shut, she nodded. "Clara," said Emma, 1,000 miles off, "you all right?" "All right," said Clara at last. "Not sick? House ain't on fire." No. "Thank God. Oh, silly me. Forgive?" "Forgiven." "Well, then, good night." And Emma Crowley hung up. Clara Peck sat looking at the receiver for a full minute, listening to the signal that said that someone had gone away, and then, at last, placed the phone blindly back in its cradle. She went back out to look up at the trap door. It was quiet. Only a pattern of leaves from the window flickered and tossed on its wooden frame. Clara blinked at the trap door. "Think you're smart, don't you?" she said. There were no more prowls, dances, murmurs, or mouse pavans for the rest of that night. The sounds returned 3 nights later, and they were larger. "Oh, not mice," said Clara Peck. "Good-sized rats, hey?" But by the 10th night, all eyes and no face, with the sounds coming in drumbeats and weird syncopations. At 3 in the morning, Clara Peck flung her sweaty hand at the telephone to dial Emma Crowley. "Clara, I knew you'd call." "Emma, it's 3 a.m. Aren't you surprised?" "No, I've been lying here thinking of you. I wanted to call, but felt a fool. Something is wrong, yes?" "Emma, answer me this. If a house has an empty attic for years, and all of a sudden has an attic full of things, well, how come?" "I didn't know you had an attic." "Well, who did? Listen, what started as mice and sounded like rats, and now sounds like cats running around up there. What'll I do?" "The telephone number of the Ratsaway pest team on Main Street is..." "Wait. Here, Main 7799. "You sure something's in your attic?" "The whole damn high school track team." "Who used to live in your house, Clara?" "Who? I mean, it's been clean all this time, right? And now, well, infested. Anyone ever die there?" "Die? Sure, if someone died there, maybe you haven't got mice at all." "You're trying to tell me ghosts? Well, don't you believe? Ghosts, or so-called friends who try spooking me with them. Don't call again, Emma." "But you called me." "Hang up, Emma." Emma Crowley hung up. In the hall, at 3:15 in the cold morning, Clara Peck glided out, stood for a moment, then pointed up at the ceiling as if to provoke it. "Ghosts," she whispered. The trap door's hinges, lost in the night above, oiled themselves with wind. Clara Peck turned slowly and went back, and thinking about every movement, got into bed. She woke at 4:20 in the morning because a wind shook the house. Out in the hall, could it be? She strained. She turned her ears. Very softly, very quietly, the trap door in the stairwell, ceiling squealed and opened wide. "Can't be," she thought. The door fell up, in and down with a thud. "Is," she thought. "I'll go make sure," she thought. "No." She jumped, ran, locked the door, leaped back in bed. "Hello, rats away," she heard herself call, muffled under the covers. Going downstairs, sleepless, at 6 in the morning, she kept her eyes straight ahead so as not to see the dreadful ceiling. Halfway down, she glanced back, started and laughed. "Silly," she cried, for the trapdoor was not open at all. It was shut. "Rats away," she said into the telephone receiver at 7:30 on a bright morning. It was noon when the Rats Away inspection truck stopped in front of Clara Peck's house. In the way that Mr. Timmons, the young inspector, strolled with insolent disdain up the walk, Clara saw that he knew everything in the world about mice, termites, old maids, and old and odd late-night sounds. Moving, he glanced through the world with that fine masculine hauteur of the bullfighter mid-ring, or the skydiver fresh from the sky, or the womanizer lighting his cigarette. Back turned to the poor creature in the bed behind him. As he pressed her doorbell, he was God's messenger. When Clara opened the door, she almost slammed it, for the way his eyes peeled away her dress, her flesh, her thoughts. Her smile was the alcoholic smile. He was drunk on himself. There was only one thing to do. "Don't just stand there," she shouted. "Make yourself useful." She spun around and marched away from his shocked face. She glanced back to see if he had the right effect. Very few women had ever talked this way to him. He was studying the door. Then, curious, he stepped in. "This way," said Clara. She paraded through the hall, up the steps to the landing, where she had placed a metal stepladder. She thrust her hand up, pointing. "There's the attic. See if you can make sense out of the damned noises up there. And don't overcharge me when you're done. Wipe your feet when you come down. I got to go shopping. Can I trust you not to steal me blind while I'm gone?" With each blow, she could see him veer off balance. His face flushed, his eyes shone. Before he could speak, she marched back down the steps to shrug on a light coat. "Do you know what mice sound like in attics?" she said over her shoulder. "I damn well do, lady," he said. "Clean up your language. You know rats? These could be rats or bigger." "Well, what's bigger in an attic?" "You got any raccoons around here?" he said. "Well, how'd they get in?" "Don't you know your own house, lady?" But here they both stopped, for a sound had come from above. It was a small itch of a sound at first, then it scratched, then it gave a thump like a heart. Something moved in the attic. Timmons blinked up at the shut trap door and snorted, "Hey!" Clara Peck nodded, satisfied, pulled on her gloves, adjusted her hat, watching. "It sounds like," drawled Timmons, "yes." "Did a sea captain ever live in this house?" he asked at last. The sound came again, louder. The whole house seemed to drift and whine with the weight which was shifted above. "Sounds like cargo." Timmons shut his eyes to listen. "Cargo on a ship, sliding when the ship changes course." He broke into a laugh and opened his eyes. "Good God," said Clara, and tried to imagine that. "On the other hand," Mr. Timmons, half smiling up at the ceiling, "you got a greenhouse up there or something? Sounds like plants growing, or yeast maybe, big as a doghouse, getting out of hand. I heard of a man once, raised yeast in his cellar. The front screen door slammed. Clara Peck, outside, glaring in at his joke, said, "I'll be back in an hour. Jump." She heard his laughter, follow her down the walk as she marched. She hesitated only once to look back. The damn fool was standing at the foot of the ladder looking up. Then he shrugged, gave a what-the-hell gesture with his hands, and scrambled up the stepladder like a sailor. When Clara Peck marched back an hour later, the Ratsaway truck still stood silent at the curb. "Hell," she said to it, "thought he'd be done by now. Strange man tromping around, swearing." She stopped and listened to the house. Silence. "Odd," she muttered. "Mr. Timmons," she called. And realizing she was still 20 feet from the open front door, she approached to call through the screen. "Anyone home?" She stepped through the door into a silence like the silence in the old days before the mice had begun to change to rats and the rats had danced themselves into something larger and darker on the upper attic decks. It was a silence that, if you breathed it in, smothered you. She swayed at the bottom of the flight of stairs, gazing up, her groceries hugged like a dead child in her arms. "Mr. Timmons!" But the entire house was still. The portable ladder still stood waiting on the landing, but the trap door was shut. "Well, he's obviously not up there," she thought. "He wouldn't climb and shut himself in. Damn fools! Just gone away." As she turned to squint out at his truck, abandoned in the bright noon's glare. "Trucks broke down, I imagine. He's gone for help." She dumped her groceries in the kitchen, and for the first time in years, not knowing why, lit a cigarette, smoked it, lit another, and made a loud lunch, banging skillets and running the can openers over time. The house listened to all this and made no response. By 2 o'clock, the silence hung about her like a cloud of floor polish. "Rats away," she said as she dialed the phone. The pest team owner arrived half an hour later by motorcycle to pick up the abandoned truck. Tipping his cap, he stepped in through the screen door to chat with Clara Peck and look at the empty rooms and weigh the silence. "No sweat, ma'am," he said. "Charlie's been on a few benders lately. He'll show up to be fired tomorrow. What was he doing here?" "Well, this," he glanced up at the stairs at the stepladder. "Oh," said Clara Peck quickly, "he was just looking at everything." "I'll come myself tomorrow," said the owner. And he drove away in the afternoon. Clara Peck slowly moved up the steps to lift her face toward the ceiling and watch the trap door. "He didn't see you either," she whispered. Not a beam stirred, not a mouse danced in the attic. She stood like a statue, feeling the sunlight shift and lean through the front door. "Why," she wondered, "why did I lie? Well, for one thing, the trap door's shut, isn't it? And I don't know why," she thought, "but I won't want anybody going up that ladder ever again. Isn't that silly? Isn't that strange?" She ate dinner early, listening. She washed the dishes, alert. She put herself to bed at 10 o'clock. But in the old downstairs maid's room, for long years unused, why she chose to lie in this downstairs room, she did not know. She simply did it, and lay there with aching ears and the pulse moving in her neck and in her brow. Rigid as a tomb carving under the sheet, she waited. Around midnight, a wind passed, shook a pattern of leaves on her counterpane. Her eyes flicked wide. The beams of the house trembled. She lifted her head. Something whispered ever so softly in the attic. She sat up. The sound grew louder, heavier, like a large but shapeless animal prowling in the dark in the attic dark. She placed her feet on the floor and sat looking at them. The noise came again, far up, a scramble like rabbit's feet here, a thump like a large heart there. I've reached the end of my reading for today. If you know someone who could use our service, or you're interested in volunteering or donating to our nonprofit to keep us on the air, it is tax deductible, please call 508-539-2030 or visit our website, audiblelocalledger.org. You can now listen to us on Alexa-powered speakers like the Amazon Echo Dot. Just say these exact words: "Alexa, Play radio station Audible Local Ledger on TuneIn, and you'll have a clear, static-free connection to our readings. As always, thank you for your continued support. Bye for now.